And now, it's time to sit back and enjoy the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Broadcast.
The Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror!
Hello, weirdos! Welcome to the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales. You know the old saying, you can't make an omelet without bursting a few chests. That's right, we're covering the Alien Quadrilogy, a lovely family series that I always find great comfort in. I mean, who wouldn't want to have their face hugged? Ah, yes, and then there's the molecular acid. Well, hold on to your DNA. It's the Alien Quadrilogy.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of the Vault of Startling Monster Horror Tales of Terror. I'm Chris Honeywell, and I'm here with the whole crew. We've got the new TFNG, Mr. Sean Engel.
Hey, everyone.
Of course, everybody's favorite, the hair metal hero.
Hey.
And, of course, everybody's other favorite, Luke Giaconetti.
Good evening or morning, everyone.
Yes, or afternoon. Who knows with these podcasts when they're listening to us. It's kind of creepy.
Yeah. They're listening to us right now.
They could be in the bathroom.
I swear 90% of my podcasting listening to goes on.
Nice.
It's for the acoustics, right?
Oh, yeah.
Of course.
I'm thinking it would be a good... Maybe I should set up my studio in the bathroom. That might be a...
I prepare all my food in the bathroom, so I'm only making...
Thanks, Prima.
It only makes sense, yeah. Anyway, we are going to do a show all about the Alien movies, seeing as how we're all psyched of after the big premiere of Prometheus. We're going to do a whole show on all the Alien movies because Prometheus just came out, and that just sort of all got us. We've been meaning to do this, and then Kong Month happened, and then now we've been all prepping to get to Star Wars Celebration, and now we're finally getting a chance to do it. And I don't know, guys. I guess we'll do all four Alien movies, and maybe we should even touch upon the Alien versus Predator quote-unquote movies.
But, well, the Alien franchise, you know, be it the, you know, the aliens themselves or the Alien versus Predator offshoot of it, it's a very rich franchise with a lot of story material in there.
Mm-hmm.
At everything from, you know, two of the most renowned science fiction films of all time to some of the absolute best licensed comics of the 80s and 90s. We've got some really cool video games. We got some great toys. We got, you know, it really does span a certain depth and breadth that not a lot of franchises can match. And, you know, yeah, are some of them less, are some of them lesser films or lesser entries? Certainly. When you get anything of this size, that's bound to happen. But, you know, at the end, it always comes back to, you know, this started out as just one movie, one original script that launched decades worth of material. You know, and there's not a whole lot of movies that can say that, especially not things that were not only genre films, but horror genre films as well.
Yeah.
Well, and that it's also kept up, for the most part, at least at the quadrilogy, a pretty decent set of movies. I mean, yes, there have been, to varying degrees, the quality of it, but most of them have been, if not excellent, at least enjoyable to watch.
I like them all, yeah. I like all four of them.
And I'm well aware of the flaws within each of them, so. Yeah. Should we give our origin stories for this particular franchise, then?
Sure.
All right. I'll go first.
Yeah, you should go first.
Brought it up.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is one of the original Alien is one of the movies that kind of explains a lot about me. My father was always great for showing me, you know, all the nerdy stuff growing up, Raiders of the Lost Ark and Star Wars, and this. Alien was on primetime TV. Jeez, I must have been five, so probably 86, probably right before Aliens came out. And my father's going to let me stay up late to watch it. And he goes, it's a good movie, but it's kind of scary. You sure you want to watch it? And I said, sure. I think we were about right to the point where they start going into the alien derelict ship. And I was like, no, I can't even get through this right now. I was wicked young. But that being said, it was one of those things that when I got another chance to watch it a couple months later, after Aliens had hit home video, I actually watched Aliens first, then went back to Alien. So it's one of those things where if I didn't have that initial frightening exposure, I don't think it just did something to me where I wanted to see what happened. The same thing with Raiders of the Lost Ark. When Cepedo gets, you know, stabbed by those wicker sticks, I'm like, nope, turn it off, can't watch it. So it's like, yeah. But eventually I was like, no, I need to see what happens. So, you know, you get a little bit older, and now it's like, I mean, that kind of created the monster. I blame my dad for my nerdiness. So thanks, Dad.
Yep, you've graduated to a Serbian tale and all that. So Serbian film and all
a
that.
A Serbian tale? I just had the most disturbing thought. You said a Serbian tale. Now yes. I'm thinking an American tale plus a Serbian film animated with mice killing each other.
You know, I hate to say it. Or worse. Know, I've read fan fiction dealing with Fievel from An American Tale. So
no.
I know what you're talking about.
Don't
ask me why I do it.
Send it to me.
One of the great non-Disney animated movies of the 80s.
I know. I'm sorry. Well, I'll go ahead and go with mine. Now, Alien, I don't remember. Alien, I don't have a definitive origin story with. Chances are I probably saw it on HBO. You know, I grew up I'm a little younger than Scott and Chris. So I grew up in the time where HBO would show movies over and over and over again because it was just one channel. So Alien, I probably caught on HBO. But Aliens, the Cameron movie, is one that I have a really vivid memory of. It was when it came out in 86, I believe.
Yeah.
And I went with some friends to our local movie theater in my little hometown. And, you know, it was just the most amazing action-filled movie. And we had no idea what it was going to be like. You know, we thought it would be a lot like Alien. And Cameron took it in such a different direction in this action-oriented film that it was just it had the same elements of horror, but it had such unique characters, which is, I think, one of the things that all the movies actually have. And it just blew me away. But by the end of the movie, we were cheering, you know, with Ripley in the loader telling the alien queen to get away from her, you bitch.
Yeah.
It was awesome. So, unfortunately, you know, my alien story isn't as interesting as my aliens. But.
Well, I'm like Hero in that I actually saw Aliens before I saw Alien. Now, Hero and I, we're about the same age. And I actually saw Aliens in the theater when I was 7 years old.
I hate you.
Wow.
With my brother, who's 2 years older than me, and my parents. Now, the story supposedly goes that my uncle, my dad's brother, had went and saw it. And my dad asked, oh, is it okay to take the kids to? And he said, yeah, it's fine.
Oh, hell yeah.
So we went and saw it. Now the thing is I don't remember being scared at all during the movie. I just remember thinking it was insane. Because at this point, you know, my dad had already let us watch The Terminator. Commando was another one we watched a lot. Raw Deal. And Conan the Destroyer. We were watching, you know, kind of movies that we probably shouldn't have been watching a lot at home already. So this was just one more for the pile. And I remember it was at least a year or two after that we would watch Aliens all the time. My brother would always ask to watch it because that was, you know, he was one of his favorites. So we finally just sat down and watched Alien. And I remember thinking, you know, that even at the time, recognizing the real differences between Alien and Aliens, and that just put me on to the entire series, and so I've been a fan ever since that. So when I was seven, I not only saw Aliens in the theater, but about a year later, right before my right before my birthday the next year, we saw a double feature. I've told this story before in the show, of Predator and RoboCop.
Ooh, so, wow.
In the same night. So that was when RoboCop was a sneak preview, so we hadn't even seen commercials for it yet. So that those two nights at the movies explain a lot about me, much the same as they do.
You had some wonderful parents.
My mom was always so mad at my dad afterwards, too. That was the thing.
Yeah, you sound like you had the same setup as me, because my mom was like, my dad would be like, he'd check to make sure the paper that there was some Disney movie playing, because we had a duplex theater, and you'd see some Disney, so he'd load up, in particular for Aliens, he loaded up me and a bunch of the guys, probably the neighbor, you know, a couple of the neighbor kids and a couple friends from school, and took us all in for pizza and a movie, and took us to Alien. And I remember my friends and I especially my friend Will Howard, who was like, a bit taller than all of us, and he was like a football player, track star, you know, big rough tough guy. But he was scared shitless during this movie. He was flipped by the time they were looking for the cat, you know, when Harry Dean Stanton's looking for the cat, he was about ready to crawl out of his skin. And my dad was loving it. My dad was just sitting there watching us, just like, oh yeah, look at him squirm. So I'm lucky. I've seen all the Alien movies in the theater, not counting Alien versus Predator movies, which I haven't even seen the second one of those. But all the quadrilogy, I've seen them all on the big screen.
I was just thinking about it. I've actually seen a good portion of the Alien and Predator franchise in the theater, because I saw, as I was saying, I saw Aliens, I saw Predator, I saw Predator 2, and I saw Alien 3 in the theater, so I did pretty good. I wasn't alive for Alien, so.
Neither was I.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I'm the old fart here.
Oh, well.
I don't care. I don't mind being the old fart at all, because I saw Alien and I saw Star Wars on the big screen when it first came out.
Ooh, that's Star Wars elitist. Blah, blah, blah. Uh-huh.
You shut your pie hole, sir. I'm in the same bag with Chris here, and yeah, I saw Star Wars in the theater and it did change me.
We're BSW. You guys are PSW. That's how I judge all people. That's the only thing I judge people on, too. So it's...
Well, there you go. We got to judge, I guess.
Yeah.
But, oh, my God. I mean, Alien, like Raiders of the Lost Ark, is one of those perfect movies for me. There's just not a missed cue in the whole thing. Not an element that's out of place.
And this was kind of a revolutionary film at the time. I mean, this film sort of set the standard for sci-fi horror. I mean, after this, there were just a glut of films that, you know, tried to ape Alien, and the sort of, you know, people on a spacecraft, you know, fighting off the unknown creature from outer space. I mean, especially, and also the art design, the Alien was something, even though you realized after a while it was a man in a suit.
Yeah, with wiggly things on his back, yeah.
Yeah, the actual design of it, that H.R. Giger design, was just so revolutionary at the time that you couldn't not be horrified by it.
Well, yeah, when I remember the first time I was seeing that movie and wondering what, you know, it, your brain couldn't process what it was till you finally saw it stand up. And even then it was hard, because there's flashing lights and fog. You're just like, what the hell is it? It's part insect, but there's human elements to it. And that's why, like, I was flipping out to get, I've always wanted to get the Famous Monsters Alien special, because it had good, clear pictures of the alien, so you could actually see what it looked like, and the Kenner action, the big, you know, giant size Kenner action figure too, or
whatever it was. Yeah,
yeah, and because in the movie it was just you had nothing to compare it to. You had nothing to figure out, you know, what the hell was going on there, you know, and then all of a sudden teeth are, you know, jaws are within jaws and all that. It was just awesome. It was truly alien. It was truly something you'd never seen before, and it was brutal.
And the interesting thing always to me about Alien is that from a story standpoint, it's not exactly groundbreaking. I mean, the story is very, very similar to the point that it's pretty much exactly the same as a very, very good but very absurdly titled 1950s science fiction film called It, The Terror from Beyond Space.
Yes.
Now, It, The Terror, with Buzz Corbin as the titular terror. Now, it's a... now, again, it's the title is ridiculous, but it's actually one of the best of the B films from the era. And it's the same story. They land, they answer a call, they land on a planet, something gets on the ship, and then it's picking them off one by one. This is not, you know, groundbreaking science fiction.
Right.
But what it does is it takes that, and first we're gonna take it and put a glaze of really, really appealing characters. You know, we get to know every single person on that ship in the time that they're, you know, that they're alive, basically. And and that, you know, that was different. That was not something that was done in science fiction or in horror, really. You know,
yeah, and everyone was given a distinct, all the characters were distinct and individual. There wasn't, there wasn't the scientist. There wasn't the 1950s stereotype scientist and all this. Each characters had their own quirks and everything. And they were all interesting characters that you could get attached to.
Right.
Well, they were all working stiffs too. None of it wasn't your standard like military crew. You know, captain this and that. You know, the captain was basically like a mid-level supervisor at a construction site. You know, he's
Dallas is essentially the foreman.
Right. Exactly. And so, you know, you just had this whole different dynamic than you were used to in a science fiction movie. Plus, Ridley Scott was basically letting all the actors improvise a lot of their lines and, you know, improvise their way through the scenes. So it had that very natural documentary look to it, you know, at times. Or not as much a documentary look as a documentary feel. A very, you know, ultra realism. You know, not just good special effects and stuff, but made you feel like you were a fly on the wall and it was completely plausible, you know.
And the ship itself looked plausible too. Mm-hmm. I mean it was a piece of shit.
Yeah.
You know?
That goes back to what we talked about on Dark Star. You know, we talked about all the different aspects of Dark Star that would go on that O'Bannon would use in Alien, and that was the first one that jumped out to me. It's like, this is a lived in ship. And prior to, you know, I mean, we talk about the 50s, 60s, even then the 70s, space was not something that was lived in, generally. Space was something that was futuristic and bright and well-lit. And, I mean, here you've got the, you know, when they come out of hypersleep, you get the fluorescent lights flickering on and, you know, people got their jackets hanging wherever and, you know, the tchotchkes on the desk and the notes and stuff. It's like, this was, you know, this is a workplace. Their workplace just happens to be a giant mining ship.
Yeah, and space by this time is kind of boring. It's not romantic and swashbuckling. It's just like, we got a long haul between here and Earth, you know.
And, you know, and when you consider this is 1979, you know, 1979 produced what, in my mind, are three of the best, physical special effects, outer space movies. And that was Alien, The Black Hole, and Star Trek The Motion Picture. All came out within about 6 months of each other. And all of them use, you know, the what was then state of the art, you know, motion control, matte paintings, matte scan in the case of Black Hole, and you know, just model building. And they all have a kind of similar approach to how space looks, except that they all approach it from different points of view. You know, the Black Hole is a throwback to the 50s. Star Trek is that, you know, utopian, futuristic vision of space. And then here, this is just space is just another workaday zone, you know? Down at the steel mill.
It sort of took the fantastical elements out of Star Wars and kept the dirty, gritty, lived in. It had a little bit of that feel of saying, okay, well, we'll take that lived in feel and we'll make it even more realistic, because that way it's even creepier when people start biting it. What's funny is when earlier you were talking about, I just watched a Mario Bava movie called Planet of the Vampires. And I noticed a lot of people had gone and watched that movie because some critic had said, you know, or they'd read somewhere that this was a forerunner of Alien. And they're just like, this is nothing like Aliens because it's people. But there was a lot of that element of, you know, an empty ship and, you know, a strange planet.
Yeah. I mean, it's the ghost ship on a planet kind of thing, you know. It's a kind of a standard sci-fi setup, but just because it's a standard trope doesn't mean we can't do something new with it, and that's what Scott does here. Scott and O'Bannon and everybody involved.
Yeah, well, I remember what really got me was this was the first time where they used video to add to the realism. You know, when you saw a lot of the introduction to the space jockey's ship,
yeah,
and stuff like that, through the video cameras on the helmets of the people walking towards it, which were fuzzy, and you know, the magnetics, you know, the sandstorm was screwing them all up, so it just anticipating Blair Witch Project, you know, by a few years. But that was I remember that being super creeping me out when I was a kid. Just it made it that much more real.
Yeah.
Because I could almost imagine if something happened and you're watching it through that screen and there's nothing you can do, you know. It was awesome.
Well,
yeah.
Part of the thing that makes all the alien stuff so scary as a geek is design. It just, in the back of your mind, there's something that's just not right about it. Like, you look at his designs, and it's just, I mean,
they are very phallic in their and some ways very sexual.
Yeah.
But in a really disturbing way, and you got to kind of wonder what Giger was doing to come up with this kind of stuff.
I don't want to know.
And part of it also is that when you first look, like if you look at Giger's paintings, it almost looks like this creature shouldn't be able to stand and move because of its proportions.
Yeah.
And then to see it moving, that adds another level of sort of unease, because it's like, you know, and we've talked about this a lot, when something, an effect is shot in camera, and this is something that George Lucas has yet to figure out, the brain recognizes something that's inside the camera frame as being real because it has mass, it has texture, it has tactility, as opposed to something that's added in CG, which lacks those things. No matter how good a CG model is, the brain usually can determine which is which. Mm-hmm. In this case, when you've got a design that is so, I hate to use the word alien, but there's no other word for it, that's so alien from what, you know, we normally would see, even for a monster in a suit, to see it move with the fluidity and the grace that it does, it doesn't seem right, because this thing shouldn't be able to move, and here it is moving. And yeah, it's real, and that's like, okay, that now I'm just creeped out.
Well, and like you said, it has weight and mass behind it. It doesn't look like something CG, which I think eventually in the series we may come upon later, because they seem to move away from the actual people in costumes to, in the later films, moving to just, you know, more CG elements,
right?
Which is disappointing.
Mm-hmm. And what's his name? Tom Woodruff Jr., who played the alien in Alien 3. Mm-hmm. He made a point, just made a comment, but it's right along with what you said, Sean, that he was having, because he was originally he was a visual effects supervisor on that film, and he ended up taking the role of the alien just because he couldn't get what he, you know, the performance he wanted. And he said that he thought that Sigourney Weaver suggested this to him after working with Ridley Scott. And what he approached to the role was as a actor, and not as a stuntman, to give the alien a character and not just be a heavy. And so they're you know, again, having the performance be a man in a suit, as much as we like to deride the term man in a suit, and we saw this just in King Kong month. Having a man in a suit as opposed to a digital effect, a fully digital effect, gives you the aspect of performance that I think sometimes you lose when you add layers of complexity. Mm-hmm. You know, the alien doesn't speak, obviously, but it conveys every emotion that you needed to convey just on the way that it moves, the way that, you know, a sudden turn of the head or something, you know, something like that. And that, I think, again, adds to the fear aspect of this. I mean, this is a living, breathing creature that is unlike anything we've ever seen, and it's not fucking friendly.
It's not friendly, and when you see it move, it's got aspects of animal, vegetable, and mineral sort of all, and insect all just sort of crunched together, you know, and...
Oh, yeah, the suit's so creepy, man. The body, like, absorbs every bit of light that's thrown at it, but the head reflects everything. It's so weird.
And then, and then And then, you know, you've got the aspect of its whole life cycle and the fact that it has insanely powerful acidic blood that'll eat through metal in a spaceship, you know, through several levels of... that's just such an awesome, awesome idea. That scene is so, you know, unexpected when it happens. It's just like, what? What's going on? It's eating through the floor. These things have acid for blood.
And you don't even
want to fight them, because if you start winning, you're going to get bathed in acid.
Right.
Yeah, wonderful defense mechanism.
Yeah, exactly.
Kill it.
And you know what? What's funny too is that, you know, we're so these characters also, they're so human that when Ash turns out to be a synthetic, that completely blindsigns you the first time you watch.
Yeah.
This weirdo, no questioner, he's a weirdo, but then they start hitting him, and all the milk starts shooting at him, and it's like, okay, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah. Well, not only the milk, but his performance, where he starts going into spasms, and then after they finally knock his head off, and he's still coming at you, that's horrific in itself, because there's this person there, this character there, that you thought for the longest time was a human being, his head is hanging off the back of his body, and he's still trying to come and kill you.
And he's
laughing. That's disturbing as hell.
It's got the only really obvious, like, post sound dialogue in there. Where
the gurgling?
I think it's Parker goes, Ash is a goddamn robot.
It's Kane, isn't it?
Is it Kane?
It's Parker. That's Yaphet Kotto.
Yeah, but it's just sort of, you could tell it was just sort of dubbed in. They're like, maybe we better have someone say it's a robot just in case, because people might be like, maybe he's an alien too or something.
What I want to know is, when they smash his head open, this is going to sound really bad, but it's like, what was that, a string of pearls? Is that a bunch of Benoit balls? What the hell is he made out of?
I don't know. I think that's kind of the point.
it's super creepy when you just see that one drop of sweat come from his temple. It's like, why is that white?
Got the fuzzy white sweat. Yeah.
Ugh.
But you know, but everybody in this movie is good. And what's funny is that watching the opening credits, I think Sigourney Weaver is third billed, isn't she? Because I'm pretty sure that Tom Skerritt gets the top bill.
Tom Skerritt.
Which is a great swerve.
Yeah, because you're thinking, okay, Tom Skerritt, I've heard of Tom Skerritt. He's, you know, he's been in other things. He's the captain. He's the, you know, the white male lead. And he's top bill. Clearly, he's going to survive.
Well, and this was also kind of innovative that they didn't make the obvious person survive, and that the person who survived, you know, was a female, was Sigourney Weaver, who I'm not certain if this is her breakout role or if this is her first role, but it's got to be one of her first roles, and it definitely set her apart as a leading role, and eventually coming to Aliens.
Yeah.
An action hero.
Right.
An action hero on the lines of Bruce Willis or Arnold Schwarzenegger or any of those.
And what's interesting also is that, you know, Ripley is not the typical science fiction scaredy cat girl anyway. I mean, she's not a action hero in this, but I mean, she's a flight deck officer. She's smart. She's tough. She doesn't take any crap. Mm-hmm. You know, She and you know, she's not like Lambert, who, you know, Lambert just kind of goes off the deep end. But she, but you know, again, it's understandable. She's a, you know, she's a navigator. She's not equipped to deal with this, you know.
Yeah.
The thing about Lambert is Lambert's pretty tough up until when the shit hits the fan, and then she just loses it, you know. But she's she's hanging with the guys. Is. Yes, yes. Oh God.
And that, if you didn't know about that, that sequence, the meal sequence where where the actual alien occurs, Ridley Scott did not tell anyone what was going to happen. He basically filmed that completely with them completely not knowing what was going to happen, except for John Hurt.
They knew something was coming out of him. They just had no idea how
they
knew
that. I think he said something's going to happen, but you're not going to know. Because if you go back and watch that scene, there is real fear on their faces in the background. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
especially you just watch them and they're like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah, you see, and that's why you get that reaction from Lambert, because
she got it in the face,
freaked out.
Well, she got a full blast of blood right in the face, you know, just kaplat, you know. And I'm sure she didn't see that coming. And yeah, that's.
and it's just so, again, you know, it's. I mean, could we have, in retrospect, it's hard to put yourself into this. But the first time you're watching it, first, if let's say you haven't seen Aliens, you know, you're watching Alien, like you did, Chris, if in the theater, fresh. You know, does your mind think, okay, well, this thing was on its face. Maybe it laid something in his chest. You know, is that the way or is this going to completely hit you like a steel chair in the back of the head that this thing is jumping out of John Hurt's chest?
Well, you see, here's the thing. Here's how they set. Here's I remember the logic that my brain was following with it is the thing was on his face and they sort of set it up. They're like, oh, this thing's making sure that he's getting oxygen and everything. It's breathing for him and making sure that he's okay. And then when it wasn't on his face anymore, they couldn't find the goddamn thing. They didn't know where it was. So we just figured that was that thing skittered off and that was the alien. It was going to grow into the alien. So, yeah, that scene came out of left field, you know. And, I wish there'd been a camera on us watching that scene. I'd like to see the look on our faces when that happened, because the whole theater was just like, you know, just flipping out. It's so intense.
I can imagine. See, I couldn't, until John Carpenter's The Thing, I cannot remember a movie that I had been as scared or freaked out by as Alien, especially that scene. I mean, that is something that just comes out of nowhere and just blows you away.
Yeah. What's interesting is that now we've seen many such chest bursters in the franchise, and yet that scene still retains its power because I don't want to say sympathize, but we feel an empathy towards the rest of the crew because they really have no idea what's going on. Mm-hmm. And like you said, Hero, the fear and confusion in that scene is extremely effective as for the viewer, because, you know, Scott is there's a certain cinema verite approach here in that, and this gets back to what you were saying, Chris, also about the headset cameras and getting video. It's not to the extent I think that we would get with some ripoffs of Alien as far as the unblinking eye. But this is the in a lot of ways the unblinking eye, because we're seeing stuff as it's happening. There's an illusion that there's no division here. You know, this is, you know, you are there kind of thing.
Yeah, there's no music during that scene either. It just follows on from them eating fucking breakfast and everything's hunky dory.
And they're eating real food. It's not space food, you know.
And the way they're talking is like, man, I can't wait to get off this ship because the food's bound to be better on Earth. And it's like, well, you sure eat a lot of it for someone who doesn't like it, you know?
I'd like to eat something else.
I mean, you know, in my line of work, sometimes I end up on job sites, construction sites. That's the way that they're talking. Or the first scene when they come off and Dallas tells Parker to go down and take a look at the vents. He goes, you mind if I finish my coffee first? That Vera, they're a mining crew. This is real people. And they're thrown into the most unreal situation. And, you know, this could be, you know, this could be a construction site down the road from your house. It just happens that they happen to be working in space. So, I mean, I think that's the real brilliance of Alien, is that it takes what could have been just a schlock fest and makes us care for these characters before sending them to a meat grinder, you know?
Yeah. The meat grinder aspect of it, though, there's really only the one, I mean, the chest burster scene is really the only guru that you get in the film. The rest of it is all implied.
Well, you know, well, the thing about it, well, when Parker finally gets his head bitten, like, I have the photo, the big coffee table size photo novel, and it has, you know, basically frame by frame, you see his head just sheared off, skull, brain sticking out, but that shot is so quick in the movie that you almost it's almost implied, it could have almost been a shot of a melon, you know what I mean? Yeah. Painted brown, and then just like, it's so quick. But it was so deep, the picture of it so detailed. So that's fairly gory, but it's only if you get to frame by frame it. Yeah, everything else is pretty much implied.
Well, and that's what the best horror movies are capable of doing. They're capable of, you know, scaring you or freaking you out without having to resort to, you know, an inordinate amount of violence or gruel.
Well, what's funny, you know, is they actually famously scaled this one back, where they cut the scene out with Dallas in a cocoon, asking Ripley to kill him because it was too horrific.
Yeah,
I don't think it was horrific. I just think it was just lame. I think they knew that this is terrible.
And of course that would become famous in the sequel.
Well, that's a good segue. Let's.
I was just going to say that's a pretty, you know.
Yeah, and just to continue the thought, I rewatched Alien. I watched the director's cut of Aliens. And I grew up watching the theatrical cut because that was what was on video and growing up. So to me, it's always weird watching the director's cut just because it takes that much longer kind of to get into the story that I remember. You know, a lot of the new material's kind of in the front end. It's, don't get me wrong, I would recommend watching the director's cut. It's Cameron's preferred cut. It was the way that the script was written. And it does add, especially to the character of Ripley, it adds some depth to her. But like I said, it's just odd. You know, after years of watching the old one now, it's like, oh, wait a minute, okay.
The extended version of Aliens is well worth watching. The director's cut the alternate cut of Alien is pretty crappy.
Well, and just let me comment on that real quick. If you have the Alien Quadrilogy box, if you read the liner note, Ridley Scott basically says, I don't like so-called director's cuts. And he said, and that the film that was released as Alien is my preferred cut of it. He says, in honor of the releasing this box that I've gone and made this alternate cut, and he actually ends his notes by saying, watch them both and decide which one you like. Which I thought was very interesting that he was so honest about it, you know, whereas Cameron, and even on the quadrilogy disc on the introduction, he says, this is my preferred one. And he goes, this was the story as it was originally intended. So it's very clear where James Cameron stands.
Well, Cameron and Scott seem to be a very different in the way they direct films, the way they do things. But yeah, the Aliens director's cut, you know, does add a lot more depth to the character of Ripley, especially puts a lot behind her motivation of why she's so intent on saving Newt.
Yeah, I think that's a big important part. I don't know how they chop that out, because I mean, getting Newt's backstory is just as important too. Randomly finding her.
The one scene, you know, the scenes that we're talking about, of course, is where Paul Reiser, what the fuck is his name, basically comes up and. I just like to call him Dickweed. But he, tells Ripley that she's been asleep for, you know, however, 58 years.
7 years.
And that she has, 57 years. And she had a daughter who passed away. So Ripley's mourning the loss of her daughter that she really never got to bond with because she was in cryo sleep for that long. And then, of course, we've got the extra scene with Newton, their parent, on LV-426, where they show them, you know, encountering the aliens for the first time and getting a bit of the old facehugger.
Yeah. And what's interesting is I hadn't noticed this until I rewatched. We were just talking about the kill me aspect. I never put two and two together, but Ripley yells that in her dream. It's where Burke comes to see her and tells her she's been asleep, and then she has the dream during that scene about the chest burster.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's what she yells at Burke, and I never really realized that until I just watched it for this show. And it's like that. I was like, that's really great symmetry. Then when the colonists, you know, kill me, you know. And of course, me being who I am, I always now think of the one, I forget which episode it is, of Mystery Science Theater 3000, where they do a play on Alien, where there's a spray-painted black version of Crow that represents...
Oh, God.
And Tom Servo is cocooned to the wall. He goes, kill me. Kill me. Give me a sandwich and then kill me. A sandwich would be great. And then, Joel runs in with the broom. Get away from her, you bitch!
It all comes back to Mystery Science Theater. That is awesome.
You know what interesting thing about the genesis of Aliens is that according to a story by Gail Ann Hurd, she was meeting with James Cameron and a couple other who released this? It wasn't Orion, was it?
No, it was Fox.
20th Century Fox, yeah.
So they were meeting with some Fox executives. They were talking about just different projects that they had that maybe Cameron might be interested in. And, apparently, the one they were there to talk about was described by Gail Ann Hurd as Spartacus in Space. And they talked about it for a couple hours, and they went back and forth, and they couldn't come to an idea of how to tell this story of Spartacus in space. And so they were shutting down the meeting. They were all going to go home. And as they're packing up their stuff, one of the Fox executives says, "Hell, you could always do Alien 2." and that kind of struck a chord with Cameron. So while he was making The Terminator, there was some delays, and he wrote what the treatment that for what would become Aliens based on this executive saying, "Hey, you could do Alien 2."
That motherfucker was busy that year because he wrote the script for Rambo First Blood Part 2, wrote and directed Terminator, and was getting ready for this. It's like,
yeah.
Man, that's crazy.
I'd be putting all my time and effort into it too if those are my projects. Holy shit! How awesome is that? Yeah.
And what's great about Aliens also is that again, I'm sorry if I remember Sean or Chris was saying this. I think it was you, Sean, that you were expecting it to be kind of like Alien, and it there is a lot of Alien in it, but much like the Terminator. You know, the Terminator and Aliens are similar in that they're both kind of high concept movies. You know, it's that the test of the high concept movie is can I tell you about the plot of a movie in one sentence? You know, and then once the concept is established and the narrative is set up, then Cameron just kind of cuts loose and the movies do not stop. And even when they're quote unquote being slow, things are just coming right after the other, and that's always been the strength of Aliens. I mean, you're talking a 2.5-hour movie that goes by, it's like, feels like 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's a lot packed in the movie. Oh, go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, it just never seems to end, you know? It has several, you know, false endings, you know? By the time she's down in the bowels, you know, with the alien queen, you're thinking, this is it, you know? This is the boss battle at the end.
Yeah.
And it just keeps going. As a matter of fact, it was one of the first movies to start that, you know, real long movie. You don't know when it's going to end, and it was successful with it. But it's not been as successful with The Imitators and successors, you know, over the years.
Well, Luke, you mentioned the movie It. Mm-hmm. From the 1950s. I guess there's a correlation here. Now, unfortunately, I don't exactly remember seeing all of it, but there's a lot of correlation between Aliens and this movie called Them, which was a giant ant movie from the 1950s. And there's a lot of scenes, specifically like the egg scene with the queen, where the movies almost parallel themselves.
In a lot of ways, yes, because Them was a film about atomic testing creating giant ants. And like regular ants, they live in colonies. And there are scenes where they're not space marines, they're just regular army, going into the colony with flamethrowers and machine guns, fighting armies of giant ants. And there's even a bit towards the end of Them where two boys are end up trapped in the sewers because they're in New York City and they're making their colonies in the sewers. And the army goes in to rescue the two boys at the climax. You know, so yes, there's a child in danger and they're going into the nest of the monsters to go get him, into the lion's den, so to speak. Which makes it a more the parallel then is goes back the other way when Hudson is describing them, he calls them an ant hive. That's because bees live in hives, idiot, you know. Bees live in a colony. You know what I mean.
Well, and that's kind of the thing that they took and kind of differed from Aliens, or at least not differed, but they more advanced the character of the aliens, was they gave them this idea that they were a colony and that they had a queen and they had a sort of hive mentality. And that made them even more creepy. You know, the fact that, you know, they work together in some sort of unity, and the fact that there was more than one of them made this movie not only more horrific, but also more action-oriented. Well, right, that there was a lot of them you had to take care of.
Well, that was the tagline, "This time it's war." Yep. You know, and that's exactly what it was.
And one of the scenes that's added back into the director's cut, goes directly to that point, and I absolutely love this scene.
The sentry guns?
Sentry guns. Because it's subtle. If you're not thinking about it, you'll miss it, because the humans, I don't even think, realize it, that they send warriors at the sentry guns until they're out of ammo. Mm-hmm. And that's it. They're doing it. It's the queen is directing them to sacrifice themselves to take out these weapons by doing it until they stop. And it's like, that is such a what now is cliche. You know, when you're whether you're talking about the Tyranid from Warhammer 40K or the I forget what they're called in StarCraft, but they're very one of the alien races in StarCraft.
Zerg, probably.
Zerg, yeah. Or just any type of alien hive mind bug behaves in this way, and now it's seen as a trope. Whereas when Cameron was doing it, this was like, okay, now the game's kind of changing a little bit. These aren't just monsters. They're highly evolved, and they're like an ant colony. They are going to go to war to survive and to thrive. You know, they're not here, you know, the colonists came there, but they're taking over this entire planet. They're spreading. They're spreading their resin, and they're becoming the dominant species here. And they're not doing it just because they're the toughest. They're outthinking people, and that's freaking even scarier.
This brings up a major point to me that I'd actually like to discuss. When you watch the original Alien, it's very much implied that the eggs release the facehuggers. They're a parasite. They're gonna throat fuck you until you, you know, pop out their child that's going to be nice. Partially based upon your physiology.
And there's our explicit tag, folks.
Yes. Sorry. No, I think we already hit that earlier.
So.
But now, I know there's a lot of fans of Alien that don't like what Cameron did in terms of having a queen that lays the eggs and having the hive structure. Me personally, it doesn't bother me. I think it makes total sense. But I mean, that was a big thing when it originally came out. Alien purists were all over it because that's not what the alien creature was supposed to be. But then again, it's like, you can't just dangle that out there and say, well, then who laid the eggs? Right. Somebody had to, you know, unless they were completely genetically manufactured. I don't know. But it's a valid point.
Well, like the scene with Dallas in his cocoon in Alien that they cut out, didn't he have a face hugger, you know, an egg in front of him, you know, so it appeared that he was going to get, you know, fed a face hugger or something, or didn't he say something like, I've got one inside of me or something like that to that effect, but that was sort of gone from it, so you never saw the alien make any eggs in Alien, so.
Yeah, and how would the alien warrior that we got in Alien, how would he have cocooned up Dallas anyway? I mean, that doesn't even make sense.
And Cameron kind of waves his hand at that by saying they secreted, it looks like secreted resin. Secreted from where, you know? But one of the strengths of Alien helps become one of the strengths of Aliens, I think. In that Alien, you know, we don't know any more than the crew of Stromo does.
What we see, yeah.
We know absolutely nothing. Here, what that allows Cameron to do is say, okay, well, if this happens, then maybe we can do this. And it's what, you know, as good as Alien was as a film, it never would have become the franchise that it is if not for some of the stuff that Cameron establishes here.
Oh, yeah, I completely agree. I have no problem with it. I just find it a fascinating topic.
I mean, the idea of the way that the Colonial Marines are portrayed, you want to talk about creating a sci-fi trope.
Oh, yeah, every video game from the 80s and 90s.
I mean, this was not the first Space Marines. I mean, Starship Troopers was written long before this, and Games Workshop had their Space Marines already before this as well, I'm pretty sure. But this took the concept of the Space Marine and not only made it wide, you know, mainstream, it made it palatable. It made it that now you say Space Marine, and every American of a certain age knows exactly what you're talking about.
You know, they
exact image in their head, and they hear the damn gun too. What the sound design in this movie was so influential that it's not even funny. You know, between the sound of the pulse rifles and the shrieking of the aliens, that is one of the most iconic sounds of all genre films of the 80s, as far as I'm concerned. Those two, you know.
Oh, and the pulse rifles themselves were really innovative guns. I mean, they were machine guns, and they had their... But I think the thing that added a bit, an element of dread to it, was it also had that ammo counter right there on the side.
Yeah.
Which they could do a close-up on and see how much ammo you had left, and that added to the, you know, that sort of countdown added more to the dread of the whole movie. That was a really innovative idea, I think.
Aliens was my first exposure to the undermounted grenade launcher, and I'm forever thankful to it.
I love it. That's a grenade launcher. You don't want to get involved with that.
No, you said you're going to show me everything. Now show me everything.
You started. You know what's funny also is that, Sean, you were talking a little bit briefly earlier about Paul Reiser's character of Burke. Now, this has always been funny to me is that my brother, to this day, anytime Paul Reiser is in a movie or TV show, he goes, I fucking hate that guy.
Uh-huh.
And he sold out the Marines and Aliens. And
yeah, fuck my two dads.
Like, you realize he's an actor, right? You know, he's like, I don't fucking care. He sold out the Marines and Aliens. He sucks. He's like, that guy's an asshole.
In fact, he's actually saying, that guy's a fantastic actor.
Oh, yeah.
Because he sold that role big time.
Oh, definitely.
Because the whole time you're thinking it's going to be Bishop that flips his shit. But no, it's Burke.
They set up every possible hint that Bishop's gonna screw her. You know, he stays in Med Bay. He calls it a fascinating creature, which I think exactly what Ash says in the first one.
Yeah.
You know, then she comes out and the dropship's not there.
Yes.
Oh, she's, and you're watching it the first time, you're like, oh, he fucked her.
Yeah.
Oh, he fucked her.
But then the great reveal of him, you know, hovering up. And I don't know how they did it, but on the shoestring budget that they had, they were able to get some amazing special effects that I think hold up really well today. I mean, there's some optical shots where you can tell it's obviously green screened or rear projection type stuff, but the ships in that and the maneuvers that they do are just so fluid that they actually look like they could be flying and lifting off. It's the ships in that are amazing, and I know that it's all model work.
It's all model
there's
work.
No CG in it.
And what's interesting also
ships
getting, you know, what the ships always remind me of are the hunter killers from the beginning of the Terminator.
Yes, definitely.
The dropship definitely looks like one. Yeah,
but they're shot in a very similar way. That's why I think the HKs still hold up, even though, again, like you say, they're relatively cheap, and it's just, you know, straight model work. But the way the camera shoots them in such a way, and they're detailed enough in the model that they really do look great, and the compositing is great. And I always loved, you know, I like Lance Henriksen as in general. I think he's a very good actor, but I really like him as Bishop. And when he comes out, he picks up Ripley and Newt, and the whole complex explodes, and they land back on the Sulaco. Just the very, just kind of matter of fact way. I'm sorry if I scared you down there. That platform was just too unstable. His delivery there is, I think it's pretty perfect, to be completely honest, because, you know, he's been, you know, Cameron has shot him in such a way that we're suspicious of him, but he's done nothing but, you know, do exactly what he said he's going to do the entire movie.
Yep.
You know, before she goes down there, he goes, in 19 minutes, that platform's going to explode. And we are, you know, again, because we've been made suspicious of him, we're thinking, oh, he's going to screw her. But he's not. He's telling her the exact truth. In 19 minutes, that platform does explode. You know, and he that's why so when he gets his from the Queen, that's just, you know, that is just a punch in the stomach, when it's like, because you know it can't be a chest burster, he's a robot.
Yeah.
And that she tears him apart, and that is, I mean, that's just like, oh no, you know.
Yeah, one half of him goes screen left, the other half goes screen right.
And we've just seen Hicks laid up and sedated, and it's like, what the hell is she gonna do now, you know?
Oh, but thankfully Cameron had us showing her doing some loading earlier. That's classic.
Yeah. Well, this is the first Alien movie was sort of like, you know, old dark house in space, but this is was the first movie to have sort of underlying themes to it, you know, the whole motherhood, the mother versus mother, and, you know, Ripley losing her child and then gaining a new child.
Yeah.
And that sort of continues on after this into the other two Alien movies too. So this is the start of like each movie sort of having some kind of underlying theme. Or at least that's my theory.
This is probably the only vag centric science fiction series out there, and I'm not ashamed to say I like them, but it's true.
The thing is that the I think, in especially in Aliens, and especially in the theatrical cut, you can watch Aliens and enjoy it on a purely science fiction action adventure level.
Mm-hmm.
And you could never even think one iota about some of the context, and you would still love the movie. Yeah. And I say this because I loved the movie when I was 7. And
I didn't think that.
And all I knew was that this was just a great movie with, you know, with space army guys fighting monsters. And Sigourney Weaver was in it. You know, so, but again, that's one of Cameron's strengths, and when he plays to his strengths is when he produces his classics. I think when he gets a little too self-indulgent is when you get kind of the overblown aspect of some of his films. And, we talked about this with Alien. One of the major strengths here also is we really do get to know all these characters. You know, really, do we really get much dialogue from, you know, Drake, or really Vasquez or Gorman, or, you know, we get a from Hudson, but even Hicks doesn't have that much dialogue until the shit hits the fan.
No, they're all very arch, but there's a reason, so that you can get to know them instantly in the 5 minutes before they start getting killed.
But and we come to know all of them, and we're on board with all of them.
Well, that's also a classic of meeting the fighting guys. You know, there's always, you know, in the comic books and the old in World War II stories, it's always the same. You know, they're all standing around bullshitting each other, and there's, you know, there's the one kid that, you know, oh, I can't wait to go see my girlfriend back home. And it's like, oh, you're dead, man. You know?
With the dialogue also, because, you know, I used to not notice, but when they get up at a hyperslip, they're all called Apone Top, which is exactly what Marines would call their sergeant. They'd call him Top Shirt or Top, you know? And then, you know, just the dialogue when they're eating breakfast. Oh, it's a rescue mission. You'll love it. We got to rescue some colonist daughters from their virginity.
Sure wouldn't mind getting me some more of that Octurian poontang. Yeah, the only simple one you had was a male. Don't matter when it's Octurian, baby.
You know, it's the same kind of camaraderie that we got with Alien in a workplace environment. Now it's taking that and putting it on a military spin on it. And it just works beautifully because, you know, so when the shit does hit the fan, you know, we know, you know, when Drake gets sprayed with acid because Vasquez shoots the alien out the door when Drake is making his stand with the smart gun and she starts flipping out. You're like, yeah, because they're the two smart gunners and we know their connection, even though we've only seen basically one 10-second scene with them.
Right.
You know, or when Hudson finally gets serious in The Last Stand, you want some. It's like, we know because we've seen him go from being the arrogant, obnoxious, super confident guy to having all of his illusions shattered to building himself back up in the span of a few scenes now that he gets dialogue. You know, he gets dragged down to his death, fighting and kicking and screaming the whole time. You know, he does at the end, he goes down to, you know, making sure that everyone else can escape, you know, and it's that to me is, again, the strength here is that, and again, much like Alien, is that these characters are, they're broad because they have to be, but they're believable.
Yeah, well, they may start out as being a little drawn with wide swath, but once the action starts and once you start getting them in context, yeah, Cameron is a master of doing that and then shading it in from that point on, you know. But first you got to get into the action, you know. He wades you right into the action. And then lets the characters develop instead of doing it all on the front and then I've never seen the director's cut. I have to see it. I'd love to see all the added scenes of, especially the added scenes of Ripley at the beginning.
Right.
It makes not a completely different movie, but if you never saw Alien, it instantly puts you on board with Ripley.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, this movie establishes the Ripley character as the warrior from this point on, as almost a Clint Eastwood now, you know, the almost superhuman in this one. This is almost her trial by fire, but still at the beginning, she still starts out kind of the tough guy, you know, just...
Oh, yeah, when she's in the Weyland-Yutani boardroom, I mean, and they're grilling her, she's not fucking around. She's like, you don't have time for this, you know, I don't... Just don't fucking go there.
Mm-hmm. Which is great, because that's the voice of the audience. That's voice of common sense from the audience that you never hear in a movie.
Yeah.
So it's refreshing to see it.
And then you get that slap across the face. Well, they've been calling us there for 50 years. You're like, what?
Oh, that's so great. It's so great. And then you're just waiting. You're just waiting how long before she gets on a spaceship and goes back there.
It's just, why? You watch it like, are you serious, bro? one of the character bits I love also is with Hicks, and you know, it's, again, it's kind of a cheat because we got to know BN playing a very similar character just 2 years earlier in Terminator, you know. Mm-hmm. But after the initial excursion, when they make the retreat back to the APC, and Burke says, well, you can't make that decision and I can't make that decision, you know, and
make him sound a little like Jerry Seinfeld.
Well, you know, Paul Reiser, I think, is always trying to be Jerry Seinfeld, so I guess that kind of fits. But I'm not about no aliens, I don't know about this, you know.
What's up with the acid blood?
How do you do a blood transfusion when you have acid blood? And,
Jesus Christ.
But then Ripley points out, well, as a military operation, the chain of command would fall to Corporal Hicks. And BN just kind of sighs and goes, yeah. You know, that tells you that and him falling asleep on the dropship. That tells you
that. Somebody wake up, Hicks.
Hudson, come here. Come here. That's me.
You know the drill. Assholes and elbows. Oh, everything. It's so It's so cliche, but it's so fucking good.
Every meal a banquet. Every
formation of parade. Another. I love the Corps.
Another glorious day in the Corps.
Ape Pone wakes up. What's the first thing he does? Puts his hat on, lights a cigar.
Oh man, I tell you that his delivery of yelling at Hudson, I find myself doing that when my older boy is being bad. Like, come here, come here.
Any questions? Yeah. How do I get out of this chicken shit outfit?
Store that shit, Hudson.
Secure that shit, Hudson.
So good. I'm Hudson, sir. He's Hicks. What's the question?
Yeah, somebody thought she said illegal alien. She got. She signed up.
Yes, Ken, have you ever been mistaken for a man? No. Have you?
Oh, man. Everything about it's so good. All right. We can do this all night.
It is replete with the most wonderful cliches that can be used in, you know, almost any circumstance whenever you're trying to cut down someone or anything. This just has just some of the best lines ever. Better than any Schwarzenegger or Willis or any of those actioners.
It's definitely up there. It is one of the dick swingingest movies ever.
And but you know what's telling in
but
a
it's
sort of...
led by Sigourney Weaver. It's all about
She's
mothers.
Got the biggest one of all.
Yeah,
and that. So in the say in you know the in very early in the film it foreshadows what's going to happen to Ripley. During the briefing, Vasquez says, "I only need to know one thing: where they are." And they start cutting back and forth after they interrupt Ripley, and she just goes, "Are you done?" And it's like, okay, yeah, that's Ripley from the first movie that doesn't take any crap. Mm-hmm. And is not impressed by their bravado because she knows what they're walking into. As I hope you're right, because whatever this one of these things killed my crew in less than 24 hours. And it's like, yeah, okay, you know, being braggadocious is one thing, but being able to back it up is another thing. And that, to me, foreshadows the kind of journey that Ripley goes on, you know, to the point that then she's, you know, strapping the flamethrower and the pulse rifle together to go, you know, to go rescue Newt.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's badass.
All right. So I we're right on schedule to move on to the scandalous half of the Alien quadrilogy now. Oh, there might not be as much raving, but
yeah. Oh, they'll be raving. It might just be more ranting.
There might be some different kinds of raving and ranting on this one. But that now Alien 3. I watched the not the director's cut, but what was
there really isn't a director's cut.
Yeah.
Right. It's
unfortunately.
Didn't Fincher sort of disown this movie to some extent?
Yes.
I mean, when they released the quadrilogy, there wasn't really a director's cut that Fincher was behind, and I don't even know if Fincher... Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a producer's assembly cut of what essentially was the script, which has some major changes, but Fincher's... He won't do a commentary on it. He doesn't want to talk about it. He's very, very bitter about it, and I don't blame him. So
in the notes, in liner notes in the quadrilogy, when it's explaining what the assembly cut is, I forget who... I don't know if anyone is credited as having written this copy, but it said that if a director's cut of Alien 3 was to be put together, essentially David Fincher would have to reshoot the film.
Yes. Well, and I think that's apparent because I was watching... Alien Resurrection last night to bone up on this, and they had the previews for the first three for the four movies, and the Alien 3 promo trailer was nothing like the movie. It essentially was aliens are coming
to Earth.
Yes. Oh yeah, that was
I think that was what the Fincher version was supposed to be, and if that was the case, that would have been fucking awesome.
There's been so many. I find Alien 3 fascinating just because of all the behind the scenes stuff. There was going to be a wooden planet made full of monks. There was going to be all sorts of shit. The Alien 3 teaser that they released was filmed so far ahead of anything even being done. It was just to raise people's awareness. There was nothing done. I mean, there was no script that was complete. Nothing was built. Nothing. It was just, yeah, we got another alien coming for you. Watch out. But,
and what,
yeah, a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff on this one.
And what's crazy to me, and Chris, I said this to you in a PM the other day when we were organizing when to record. I said that, you know, I watched the theatrical cut of Alien 3 because that's the one I'm familiar with. That's the one I saw in the theater and so forth. And what's absolutely blows my mind is for a film with this troubled of a production, the movie...
It's pretty good.
It's pretty good.
Well, I think. I mean, I may be a little prone, again, because I saw this when I was 12 in the theater, and, you know, just the idea of seeing another Alien movie on the big screen, you know, I was a little saucer-eyed. But taken as it is, I think it's a good movie. Now, that does require you to kind of table whatever emotional response you may have to the off-screen, for lack of a better term, you know, elimination of Hicks and Newt. And that, to me, of all the stuff that happens in narrative-wise in the Aliens films, that is the biggest cheap shot of all. Because at the end of Aliens, you know, Ripley and Hicks have got a connection. You know, Ripley and Newt, you know, they've become surrogate mother and daughter. Bishop is, you know, has given everything to help them. The family has come together. And now, literally in the first 5 minutes, it is torn apart. And in such a way that it's so it's not... How do I put this?
It's sadistic, it's almost.
Yeah, it's cruel.
I love it. Well, to I Ripley. Love that fact.
And from a narrative standpoint, I like that because Ripley finally got some semblance of peace, and now not only has all of that been ripped away from her, now there's another goddamn alien on this planet too.
Well, she's also been handed a death sentence.
Yeah.
That we know about. I watched the extended cut, so I noticed, and I watched the theatrical cut when it came out, and I noticed some differences between the two, but I'm glad that you watched the theatrical cut, so we'll pick out some. But in the cut I watched, you know, you saw just, it's like a methodical cutting back and forth of the credits.
Yeah.
And you know, see, which I remembered in the theater, but you see one shot of the face hugger on her face.
Yeah, in the theatrical cut, you see it attack Newt's hypersleep chamber, and that's Fraxer chamber. But you don't. It's implied once they do the autopsy on Newt, we all pretty much know. Okay, well, it kind of had to be on her then, didn't it?
Right, it had to be on somebody.
They don't come right out and say it, and you know, but the. I agree with you, Hero, also, that from a narrative standpoint, I like that everything's been ripped away from her. But looking at it from a metatextual standpoint, as a fan of the series, it pisses you off.
Oh, yeah. It's brutal. It's fucking. Like, it would have been one thing if they had got Michael Biehn and some girl to, you know, just play them and, like, maybe they die when they crash or some shit like that. But no, you don't even get that. It's you back to Ripley's story. It doesn't matter what else is going on.
Well, yeah, in the one I saw,
she can't have anything good.
Yeah, and it's just her. It's just her. She's the only one that's allowed to survive. Yeah,
we can't have nice things.
And
when it's done off camera, like it was in the movie, when there's really no mention of the characters aside from, like, you know, screenshots of what's going on, it feels even worse because you don't get to say goodbye to them. You don't have that. You know, for lack of a better word, that closure with them. It's just they're ripped away from Ripley, and that makes it all the more difficult for her.
Well, but we feel it too. That's what's great about it.
Well, I
specifically in the theater, being absolutely floored that they killed Hicks and Newt off screen at the beginning. I'm like,
the opening credits.
I mean, yeah. It's just one of those where, you know, like when, like if you're standing on a sidewalk and you watch a car crash happen.
Mm hmm.
It's you can't do anything about it. You're just kind of staring incredulously. That was what I felt. I was like, they
really?
They killed Hicks and Newt and bitch. I'm like, what? You know, I mean, we had just watched Aliens that afternoon, for crying out loud. Kill Hicks and Newt, but you know, there it is. So
and when in the cut I watched, when they pull the ship out of the water, you see a shot of Hicks' body where his head is just mangled. You know, there's like part of his jaw over here and an eyeball over here, and then you get to see Newt's body on the slab with Sigourney Weaver, you know, so not only are they killed, but you're watching their bodies, you get to see their bodies get tossed in the fire. It's just like, no, they're not coming back. Nope. Oh, there they go into the fire. They're gone. Yep, that's right, they're dead.
And then we get poor poor Ripley is stuck where? With a bunch of
double Y chromosomes.
Homicidal men.
Mm-hmm. You don't want to know me, lady. Mm-hmm. Really? I am a rapist of women and a murderer. I've always remembered that line.
Oh, Charles Dutton. He's the fucking balls in that movie, man. He's so good.
That's the thing. That's what makes it all more frustrating.
His face is like a balled up fist in that whole movie.
But, you know, it's so frustrating because I like this movie. I like the story of Ripley stuck on this planet. And I like the story of Dylan and his, essentially his congregation that have found salvation here at what she calls the ass end of space. You know, I love her little monologue where she says that, you know, when this thing was on my ship, it was crew expendable. And then we came in with a squad of Marines and it was crew expendable. You think they care about a bunch of lifers who found mm-hmm. God's ass end of space? No, we're crud. And it's like, oh yeah. It's like the anger that she
said we're crud, and then she said like we're fucked, and I'm like, why would you say crud before? Why didn't she just say shit?
I assume she said crud as kind of an ironic thing because they were in a smelting facility.
Huh.
Thought that was kind of because she could have said we're slag and it would have been the same
right.
kind of thing, you know.
See, the thing is, if you have Newt and Hicks in this movie, though, it doesn't work.
No.
There's no way it could work. Because, yeah. I mean, he's still a Marine. He's going to call up HQ and get them, you know, rescued in two seconds.
Newt's presence there would bring up all kinds of disturbing things that you wouldn't need in this story.
Fincher would probably go there, but that's not the story.
As it is, we already have Ripley being attacked and almost raped, you know.
Yeah. They picked the wrong chick to fuck with, though.
Yeah, well, yes, but it's still, you know, you're right, adding a prepubescent girl into that type of environment would open all sorts of doors that
How long was it, 78? No, she's like 86 years old after that, right?
It's still prepubescent.
I know.
You know who I would have liked shown up on Fury? Planet Fury would have been a nice touch somehow. Is if Jonesy showed up on the planet some. I don't know how. I don't know how you'd pull it off. I just think that'd be something.
Well, here's where something else that was different in the extended version. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the theatrical cut, the alien, the face hugger attaches to a dog, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
In the one I watched, it's an ox. One of their oxes that had been pulling in the ship had collapsed, and they bring it into where they got chickens and stuff, like their little slaughterhouse, and they sort of hang the ox up on the hook, and you see one of the guys sort of pick up a spent face hugger, and he's like, yeah, what's this? And he tosses it. And then they have this whole intercut scene with a sermon intercut with the alien slowly making its way out of the ox's body.
That scene, the second part you're talking about where it's intercut with Dylan giving his sermon with about rebirth
mm-hmm.
and the alien hatching from the host is the same in both, except it's obviously shot again, but it does the same thing happens when it's hatching from the dog. It's in the same scene as it is with the ox. It's just obviously reshot.
See, I think the ox works better in a religious sort of in that sort of religious birth context of thing. You know, oxes just have more of a biblical sort of feel to them, you know, born of an ox, or it should have actually been born of an ass, but or something.
Well, the thing about the
born of an ass is a porno movie I just saw the other day.
that's like the Jason Bourne porno.
Yeah, exactly.
But the thing with the dog versus the ox is, I'm willing to buy the dog, just because of I don't think of an ox as a particularly fast moving creature. You know, I'm holding in my hands, we talked about this a little bit before we went on the air, the Kenner Bull alien toy from 1992, and it looks kind of like the alien from Alien 3. It's quadrupedal, it's got kind of a long head, but it also, and it's got claws on its front, its front legs, and its tail curves up, but it has two bull horns on the front, like a longhorn steer. Now, if the alien in Alien 3 had looked like my bull alien toy, yeah, I could buy that being an ox, because it's got some heft to it. It could gore you, you know, the type of things that I would expect from an ox. The runner alien from Alien 3, I mean, that is a fast, lithe creature. So I could buy it being a dog, that what it's going to take is a dog's ability just to sprint outright and to track down and hunt prey.
Well, this is one of the things that this movie sort of established, is that the alien takes on characteristics of whatever the facehugger attaches itself to.
Right.
You assume in, you know, the first and second movie that it attached at least something humanoid because the alien looked more humanoid. In this one, yeah.
It's bipedal. The alien, this one, it's quadrupedal.
Yeah, this one has a lot more aspects of what the dog would have. And I don't think, you know, you're correct in it having symbolism with the whole religious, you know, thing that was going on at the same time of the birth of the alien, but having it be an ox and then the alien having, you know, characteristics of an ox just doesn't work for the way the alien acted in the rest of the movie.
Yeah. Right,
having it
right.
be a dog was more plausible, at least in that standpoint.
And I tell you what, Sean, doing that again has helped this franchise in so many ways, because you've opened so many avenues. You've taken a creature that we've already established is, you know, please retain this image for a later nightmare, and now we're adding elements from other scary real animals to it.
Yeah, what if it hooked up with a bird or something, you know?
I mean, and again in 1992, like I said, the Kenner toy line was released. That was the whole gist of all the aliens, but that they were things that were breeding with, took on the characteristics of other animals. Besides the bull, we got a gorilla-style alien that was short, but had long arms and was bulky like an ape. We had a mantis alien that looked like that was, you know, had arms like a praying mantis and could, you know, and could spit venom and things like that. And, you know, they just got more and more, you know, kind of crazy as the line went on. But that, again, was the, you know, it further developed this idea that this is a race that it's designed to go into an environment and become the dominant species. Whatever dominant species is, they're going to take the best traits of that they can and then kill everything else. So, I mean, that comes from Alien 3.
Okay, well, see, I'm thinking all it took from the bull was quadruped. That was about it, you know.
Hero, you had something to say?
Not that I can recall.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, you know, on the whole idea, just to go off movie topic, I know DC released some Alien crossovers. I know Dark Horse did the big Aliens crossovers in the 80s and 90s, but Alien had some, DC had some Batman versus Aliens, and one of the odd things about that was they had an alien that had attached itself to a crocodile. Now, I know this sounds ridiculous, but we had a crocodile alien that Batman was fighting, if I recall. So, you know, anything that they could do to make a new life form from the alien, they could do it. And it was cleverly used in this movie.
And of course, the, you know, right a good jab, blah, 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 blah. Shortly before Alien 3, what comes out is Predator 2. And we get to the final reel of Predator 2 and Danny Glover's character with the Predator ship and sees the trophy case. And what's there front and center of the trophy case?
Xenomorph skull.
Alien skull. And so that just planted the seeds in all of our brains. Like, oh, man, they're in the same universe. And what did that, the law of the inevitable. What does that eventually lead to? An Alien versus Predator Requiem, the Predalien. It's like, if an alien managed to implant itself in a predator and the predator didn't kill itself with the before the chestburster came out of him, you know, this for dealing, you know, putting that aside, it's like a Predalien, you know, why don't we just call it what it is? You just call it Predalien. We're pretty much fucked.
Yeah. We're done. Done. Yep.
Like, you could just kill me now, if that's all right. I'd like to avoid the lines later, so.
If a predalien, then attack Chuck Norris.
Chuck Norris wins.
Charles Bronson.
Charles Bronson.
Ooh, Charles Bronson. Nice.
But, you know, getting in on, you know, with Alien 3, I mean, Just as far that what a lot of this film kind of brings back is the real sense of isolation that Alien had, you know, because in Aliens they have, yeah, they're isolated, they're in the middle of nowhere, but they do have the ship, they have a plan to get off the planet. It's a long shot and it requires, you know, some you know, things that are very difficult, but there is a plan. Here they're really in the ass end of space. They have nothing.
They have and they're truly disposable. There's no plans of them ever coming back. A few people are switching in and out, you know, the warden and his helper and stuff in 85 are switching in and out, but that's about it. Everybody else is going to be there till they die, you know.
Yeah. And so Ripley and Dylan kind of rallying everybody up is, you know, it's like, it goes back to the religious, you know, the fact that they had found their salvation was, you know, are you you going to die on your knees or are you going to die standing up? And then I love again when Dylan is attacked by the alien in the forge, you know, he's defiant to the very end. He's a lot like Hudson in that respect. He's defiant to the end. He knows he's dead. You know, even if the alien doesn't kill him, he's in the middle of the forge. He's going to be, you know, he's going to be immolated. But it's, are you going to die on your knees? Are you going to die on your feet? And I really like that, that aspect of the film and that kind of theme. Because when all seems completely hopeless, you know, you can't, are you going to, you know, you're going to give up? Are you going to just give in? Or are you going to fight it? You know, and I think too often, especially, I mean, and I'm not going to get on my soapbox here, but there's a lot of people in the society we live in who just say, oh man, fuck this. You know, they would die on their knees by choice, and that is so bizarre to me. That, and so I like that a film espouses that kind of die with your boots on attitude. You know,
yeah, well, in this movie, it isn't very far to go to be like, well, you know, really, we have nothing to lose. You know, I don't really think you had to do a lot of convincing with them to be like, you're gonna die. How do you want to die? Do you want to die fighting or not fighting? But you're going to die, so you might as well die fighting. And okay. You know, but the funny part was when they were like, hey, let's go down by the furnace. That's fire. And everybody was like, yeah, because it was like finally some sort, something that sounded concrete that they could do. But, yeah, the isolation in this isn't just physical. There's a, you know, Ripley is, you know, just, you know, personally isolated in this, and then she finds the doctor who she can sort of vibe with, and by that time she pretty much knows she's got an alien in her and that she can't live. So I figure she's just like, I'm gonna have sex, you know, because I haven't in a long time.
It's been like 200 years,
and she has nothing to lose. Exactly. And but then immediately after they have sex, he's a goner. You know, he's done. He gets chewed right up. So
that's after he tells his sob story too, isn't it?
Right. He gets his big moment of catharsis, cathartic story, and it
kind of goes back a little bit. I mean, we're expecting it more, but it kind of goes back a little bit to Dallas. Mm-hmm. You know, we're introduced to this character. He does the autopsy on Newt. You know, him and Ripley bond. They confide in each other. He lies for her. He lies to the guard about we don't want an outbreak of cholera. And then, you know, they're intimate with each other. He tells her his story, and then he's killed. Now, it's in this case, it's substantially more cynical, of course, than it is with Dallas. But it was 1992, so you know, it's like 1992 cynical. Yeah, okay.
And to the lived-in part, like, when they're in the mess hall, all the, like, insane scribblings on the wall was totally, I could see that, like, being the forerunner of the set design on Seven when Fincher, you know, finally got to do Seven. And, but, yeah, I remember when I saw this in the movie, my thought was, wow, this is sort of like the theme of this one is like the battle of the sexes. Although now watching it again, I've amended that too. It's also about the stages of grief.
Yeah.
Because Ripley goes through all the stages of grief through this. Ugh.
Yeah, this one's definitely acceptance at the end.
And then acceptance at the end, you know, and bargaining where it's like, we can actually kill it and maybe get out of this alive. And then it's just like, no.
Yeah.
Until she just willingly, you know, gives her life. And in the version I saw, there's no chest burster at the end. She just falls into the flame and burns up. There's no alien pops out at the last second to just be sort of like, hi, I'm here. Whoa, shit.
I'm torn because I think it's kind of an interesting visual that she grabs it and hugs the chest burster to her.
Yes.
And I like that because it's almost as if, you know, the only constant in her life has for as long as we've known the character has been the aliens.
Yeah.
The closest thing to intimacy that she's allowed anymore is this thing growing inside of her.
And in death, that's the last intimate act is birth.
But by the same time, it is a little bit of a stretch that it bursts.
It's also a part of the thing. It's like, it's an alien movie. We got to see a chest burster.
This is true as well.
Yeah. I think her performance in that one is just as on par with her performance in Aliens.
Oh, yeah.
She's, man, like, she crashes, they're dead. It's like, things just can't get any worse. Oh, yeah, they can. Now you're going to shave all your body hair. It's like, oh, there's a bunch of dudes that want to rape you. Oh, things just keep getting worse. It's like, oh, man. She's such a great character, but my God, does she go through a lot of shit for our enjoyment.
Well, yeah, and quote-unquote enjoyment. That's another thing is, like, as far as an enjoyable movie, I like this movie a lot, and I like it even more after watching it again. But it's not... like an enjoyable, you know, it's there's not a lot of woo, this is cool, or wow, this is awesome.
It's not, but it, I mean, ostensibly, it's dark. Yeah, ostensibly, it was supposed to be the end. I mean, did you really see a happy ending for Ripley?
No, yeah, exactly.
There's no way. I mean,
if even there's if a happy ending for it, just leaves it open for another movie anyway, so yeah. But even, yeah. I guess, even not, it still left it open for another movie or. You can never stop it.
I can make it up a franchise.
Yeah, it did leave it open for a fourth movie. As ridiculous as the premise is for bringing, you know, Ripley back, but they went ahead and made it.
It's just as plausible as anything else in the series.
Yeah, I mean that to me has always been kind of a sticking point with Alien Resurrection because. The film, again, taken on its own merits, it has its good points, it has its bad points. But to me, even to bring back the character of Ripley, even as, in the state that the character is in Resurrection, after the, you know, it, I mean, really, Alien 3 is a story of her as a martyr. Because, like the classical definition of a martyr, it's not someone who just simply sacrifices themselves for the betterment of others. It's someone who is, you know, forced to endure terrible punishment and pain and then sacrifice himself. And that's what happens to Ripley in 3. So it always cheapened Alien 3 to see Sigourney Weaver back out there and being called Ripley and everything else. Even
but
though
she's not really Ripley though. So I that kind of
why don't you make the movie without Sigourney Weaver then? Make the, you know, make her a, you know, oh, she was grown from Ripley's DNA. We'll call her, you know, we'll just call her, you know, Ellen or something and have it be a story point. But having Sigourney Weaver on there always kind of bugged me. I understand that she's, you know, the only real, you know, she's the only person associated with all these movies. But I thought her end was so fitting that to have her back out there to me always kind of rubs me.
I don't know. Well, that was Ellen Ripley's end.
This is something else. Here's where I'm going to get scandalous. I love this movie. I love it. I was in the theater going...
That's okay. So that.
I love the director, and and maybe it's because I love the director, so because it's not... It doesn't feel like it's in the regular alien world.
No,
it's almost
doesn't.
Like a fever dream of the alien world.
It is so... There is so much black humor in this one.
Well, that director, it's his style is like that. And then when I found out that Joss Whedon wrote it, then it was like, oh, that makes perfect sense. That's what gave it that sort of comic booky feel to it too. But you know, like the mad scientists and stuff are, you know, they're almost like out of a storybook or something, you know. And
oh yeah, it's very broad.
Yeah,
but well, you know, and
not only the mad scientists, but the members of the crew of the Betty mm-hmm. are pretty much, you know, prototypes for what Whedon was going to do later with this show Firefly in the movie Serenity. I mean, if you don't see, you know, what's his name is Mal, and the guy from Beauty and the Beast
from
is
Beauty
Jane.
Beauty and the Beast is Jane, yeah, for definitely
you know,
is Jane.
You know, I don't know, you know, how you can't draw that correlation. And I know I'm waiting to hear Luke tear into it because I know he's not the biggest, you know, Firefly fan.
Well, and it's not even that. The thing with Whedon is that, and again, I've gotten in trouble for this opinion, is that Whedon is a guy who is he's a good writer, but he writes the same characters all the time, and he's a guy that falls in love with his concept, and then his concept is king, even if it's not his concept. The problem I've always had with Firefly is that essentially it's he watched the anime Outlaw Star and said, oh my god, nobody's ever seen this in the US, I'll remake it.
I've heard that comparison before, and to me it's very tenuous.
I think it's right there, because I saw Outlaw Star long before I saw Firefly, and I remember what my friend Adam lent me the Firefly DVDs, and I was watching them with my wife, and we got to the last when we see the box in the first episode, I go, there's a girl in that box. And she goes, "Why? How do you know that?" I said, "Because I saw this when it was called Outlaw Star." But anyway, the point is that, you know, Whedon is he's a good writer, but sometimes he gets so in love with his own concepts that he loses the plot. Is always been my kind of take on it. And I don't know if this was his writing or if this was an edit or something, but Alien Resurrection has one of the in my mind the absolute dumbest bits ever in the Alien franchise, and that includes the two AVP movies. You know, at one point, the aliens are trying to get through the barricade, and so they throw themselves at it until they spill enough of their blood to burn through it. Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Seems a lot very similar to what they did with the Sentinel guns in Aliens, right? Okay, I'm willing to accept that. Two scenes later, they're spitting acid. Why didn't they just spit acid?
It wasn't spitting acid. Wasn't one of them biting them? Doesn't he put the inner mouth through his face and it?
Yeah, but they're spitting it, and it's like,
I'll have to rewatch it.
Yeah, but maybe just ripping each other apart is gets more acid out there faster than spitting it.
So to me, Alien Resurrection, and it's a whole other animal, like you said, Chris. It's just something. It to me, this is not really a sequel to Alien 3. This is just, hey, we're going to restart it, and we're just going to use the name and control.
Yeah, that's definitely what it felt like. It didn't feel like a continuation. I mean, you could see the first three Alien movies being a part of a trilogy and, you know, one building upon the other. This one feels like someone in Hollywood said, hey, you know, these three movies made a lot of money. Why don't we make a fourth one? Well, the main character's dead. Well, screw it. We'll just bring her back as a clone.
Yeah.
Well, do we know what the timeline is? Is it far in the future from?
Oh yeah, it's
2 years or something, isn't it?
It's ridiculous. It's gotten to the point where McDonald's bought out, or Walmart bought out Weyland-Yutani. So,
which is funny in and of itself. So,
yeah.
It's what you later find out is that the By and Large Corporation ends up buying out Walmart. So, yeah.
But you know, so
Weyland-Yutani, I love you.
So it's almost like an alternate universe one.
Sorry, that was awesome, Sean.
It took a second to sink in.
It's
like an alternate universe story almost. But I love it because it really gives Sigourney Weaver a chance to just really, like, she did a good job of playing Ripley mixed with an alien, having, you know, you in this one Ripley almost takes the role of the android, where you're like, I don't know whose side she's on, you know. I don't know what, you know, you can't tell if she's playing a game through the whole thing and she's going to turn on the humans or what the deal is in it. And I thought that was really well played. I thought that was the only, like, that and Winona Ryder were the only characters that were developed at all in that. All the other characters were just sort of, like, comical or, you know, just very thin characters, although I liked them. You know, they were well designed, but they weren't very deep, you know.
It's not a deep movie at all.
No. Yeah.
It's almost as if, and again, I may be bringing a personal bias here. It's almost as if this film was designed sort of like a pilot. You know, you think about a pilot to a television series. You know, we get introduced to the high concept. Okay, we get introduced to what the ongoing story is going to be. We get introduced to the characters and we get a little bit about them, but we don't get told too much about them because we're going to learn about them as the series progresses. So this is almost kind of like that. You know, it's like, okay, new concept, new setup. We're bringing in the star from the movie because it's the pilot and we can afford to do that. She won't be around in the series. You know, we accept that. Here's the characters that we're going to be following. Here's the world they live in. Here's the ship that they're on. You know, here's the menace that they fight. And so I think kind of the lack of depth a little bit on some of the characters was, it was almost written like, well, maybe they'll, maybe, you know, we might make a sequel to this and then we'll learn more about, you know, Ron Perlman and Winona Ryder and all that and the rest of the crew here. See, I mean, maybe I'm talking on my ass. I don't know, but that actually makes sense.
It doesn't bother me though. I honestly think the only really egregious thing in this, in Alien Resurrection, is the fucking terrible creature design of the newborn thing at the end.
Of bouncing baby alien.
Oh my god! I'm sitting there watching the movie. I'm enjoying it. It's like a carnival ride. This one, everybody's having fun, which is fine because they just went completely morose with the last one, and then you get to that, and it's like. Really? What the fuck is that? It's not scary. It's not even sweet looking. It's just pitiable looking. It's like, it's not even interesting.
Well, the thing was, they finally gave it eyes.
Oh, and I can't that, do this.
That takes away from the... That takes away from the...
Alienness of it.
Yeah, the alienness of it. It takes away from that. It makes it... more pitiable, actually, and that ruins the whole concept.
Well, it was a mewling pity, but I think the underlying theme of this movie was what makes you human, you know? And the funny thing is, at the end of the movie, the two most human characters are the robot and the half alien, you know, seem to have less. Are more noble humans, you know. It sort of does this, like, you know, maybe, you know, what makes you human are your actions, you know, or how you deal with other people and stuff like that. But yeah, but
if that was the point, then it didn't come across well enough to me.
Well, it came across to me, but the big fat bouncing baby boy alien didn't really play into it very well, you know. It was sort of like, okay, that thing is, it's getting more human, but it just didn't make sense.
It also doesn't help to me that it looks almost like they ripped off the aliens from Independence Day, because I think that came out before this, I believe, right?
Yeah,
or I got it backwards.
Oh,
so,
no, yeah.
I mean, with the chicken legs and the long arms and the long legs, it's like, okay, well, that we kind of just saw that with Independence Day. The other thing that I want to talk about, and I don't know if I should bring this up or not, was the original design of the hybrid that was edited digitally in post-production was that it had genitalia, which was both male and female genitalia mixed together.
Which would be very H.R. Giger style.
And, 20th Century Fox said no.
No, yeah.
And Janae changed his mind on it, and the quote apparently said that it was too much even for a Frenchman.
Well, like, one of the things I really loved about this movie is the opening title sequence with the just big blobby mass of flesh globbing around. Yeah, it's just beautiful.
And, oh, yeah, it's a great-looking movie.
Yeah, and you get to see the aliens swim, and you see how, like, naturally they take to, how they take really well to the water.
The special effects are good. The action's good. It's a fun movie, but it's just, in terms of, like, the whole echelon of the four movies, it's definitely the lowest on the totem pole.
I agree.
It's the outlier, too, you know. It's the one that's, it's the, you know, I'm doing air quotes up to the mic here, it's the weird one.
Well,
you know?
I don't know. I hate to disagree with you guys about it, but I thought a lot of the times the special effects, especially for like the exterior shots of the ship and everything, looked really kind of cheesy. I mean, some of the, you know, the shots of the Betty maneuvering around and the way and all that, but like the long shots of the ship and the starfield just looked very sci-fi to me. And this was also kind of the advent of early CG. And you could tell that in some of the scenes that they couldn't get actual people swimming around in the alien suits, that a lot of the stuff was CG aliens. And I think we talked about this a little at the beginning. Your mind can tell sometimes when something has heft and weight and when it doesn't. And there are a few scenes in this, like I'm trying to remember, like when the alien was climbing up the ladder, that it didn't look like it was a person in a suit. It looked like it was CG, and that was kind of upsetting as well. I know they've got the technology and they wanted to use it, but it just, I'm just not the biggest fan of CG, especially for when you can do so much better with live people in suits.
Yeah, but you knew it was going to happen. I mean, for 1997 special effects, I'm saying they're good. I mean, was it 97, 95? I don't even friggin' remember anymore.
Well, he's sort of like, he reminds me of Terry Gilliam a little bit, whereas his special effects aren't always going to go for total realism. You know, they might go into the fantastical a little bit, or the more like set, they look more like they're set designed rather than, you know, designed for practicality, which was sort of more the trope of the other Alien movies, is everything was very... there's a use for everything, and a lot of this reminds me of like the European comics of the 70s through 90s, like that you would see in heavy metal and stuff like that, where space was, you know, the spaceships were kind of like, you know, the mad scientist lab was kind of artsy, you know, and the layout was a little bit more, you know, interesting looking. I love the scene where they're messing with the aliens with the freezing cold spray, and the aliens just get the better of them. That was a great scene in the movie. I was just like, you know, I'm sitting there watching it, going, "Ooh, he's making me root for the aliens." I want to see these aliens mess somebody up. You know,
I will say this: the only moment of where it really feels like an older alien movie is when 9 or 8, or I can't remember what the hell number she is, the Ripley clone finds the fucked up Ripley clones and euthanizes them all. That to me is like, oof, it's just depressing and heartbreaking and disgusting all at the same time.
Well, especially like, when she finds the one that's,
can
that's
speak,
out, of the,
yeah.
out of the sort of back to tank or whatever.
Yeah.
It's just horribly, hideously deformed with, you know, her one arm, you know, bent up over her head. And,
that's the only point where I think this one really, I don't know, strives for something serious. That being said, it does have my second favorite chest-bursting scene in the entire movie. I think you all know which part that is. He grabs the dude's head, puts it right up to his sternum.
Oh, yeah.
That part's great.
Well, you see, this movie has a lot more ridiculousness in it than the other ones. It's awesome. Yeah, it's, you know, got that shade of Evil Dead 2 in it, you know. You know, the guy with his wheelchair, with, you know, he's got his blaster, like, in his weapons and pieces in his wheelchair so he can just put them together. I love that.
Yeah, it's a fun movie. It's not...
It's like I said, to me, it's the outlier. It's the one of these things is not like the other, you know. Mm-hmm. So.
Well, and maybe it's the fact that they tried to have fun with this movie that differentiates it from the other three. That the other three were pretty serious. I mean, Aliens had some jokey moments with the characters, but still, it was an action-oriented movie. And Alien and Alien 3 were more horror movies. So the fact that this one has a bit more, is having a bit more fun with itself, you know, kind of differentiates from it. Maybe not so much diminishes it, but, you know,
takes it in
a different direction.
I mean, I'd rather have that than just a repeat of 1, 2, or 3 again.
Well, by this time, with all the comics and stuff, if you were reading the comics, you sort of got used to getting different takes on the Alien story, you know?
That is a really good point, because unlike Dark Horse at this time, they had what were generally referred to as the big three for licensed comics, mm-hmm. because they had the license for Alien, they had the license for Predator, and they had the license for the Terminator. And they basically did a nonstop series of miniseries for these three properties. Now, the Predator ones and the Terminator ones all were generally just, you know, dark, serious shoot-em-ups, you know, as those properties were at that point, you know. Those properties were about, you know, aliens hunting things down and killing them, or about thermonuclear war robots. So, you know, the Alien ones, because of the fact that we had already established in Alien 3 that you could create different types of aliens, those stories already were taking place on different planets, there was deep space exploration, there was things like that, that those were more, they had a much bigger variation from what would you get from one series to the next. You know, generally the Terminator stories took place on Earth. You know, the Predator stories took place on Earth, generally. You know, were they in the jungle? Were they, you know, in the city? That kind of thing. Here it's like, well, we could be on a completely different planet. You know, the only connection would be that Weyland-Yutani was involved somehow, and then there would be, you know, there would be an alien infestation. So you're right in that sense of that, you know, the comics were really showing us that we can take things and do different things with it. And again, I think that gets back. If they had gotten, you know, something like we got in the comics, if they had done that, they would have had a clone of Ripley that didn't look like Sigourney Weaver, because they wouldn't have been allowed to use Sigourney Weaver's likeness. And I think that might have helped this film a little bit too. I think bringing in, I love Sigourney Weaver. I think she's a great actress. You know, we've all seen her in her underwear enough times at this point. It almost smacks of, well, if you're gonna make an alien movie, you gotta have Sigourney Weaver in it, and I think that may.
That's
I think
not
that
true, may, yeah.
Not true, you know.
So far, it's true because I haven't seen the second Aliens versus Predator, but I saw the first one and I hated it. It's
pedestrian. It's boring. It's like, oh, you have this fantastic idea for two of the greatest movie monsters of the last 30 years,
yeah, and
you have it set on Earth, and it's boring with boring human characters.
It's not, I don't mind the Earth setting, and we've talked about this offline before, because it's not set in, you know, Los Angeles, it's set in the Arctic, and it's in that strange
underground place. Yeah,
it's still kind of an exotic locale, even though it's Earth. But the second point you make here, I will agree 100%. It's Alien versus Predator, and it's boring.
Yeah,
and it's, that does not jive with me, especially again when the Alien versus Predator comics. There was several different Alien versus Predator comic series.
They were all pretty good, though, if I recall.
They were pretty good, and all they basically took was the basic setup that the Predators used the alien as hunting stock, and even the story. I don't have any problem with that. The idea of the three Predator Braves coming here to hunt the aliens as kind of their, you know, coming of age trial, I don't have any problem with that. But then you make the story so, I don't mean to quote you, but pedestrian is the perfect word for it. Make the story so pedestrian that it's like, you don't even, it's like, okay, you don't even really care that much anymore.
No, I didn't give a shit about any of the human characters in that movie.
I would have wiped out the human characters, except maybe one. I would have wiped them out as soon as they got to the temple. Have the aliens just ambush them and tear them apart. And maybe you've got one, you know, who we get to see things through. Maybe, you know, she runs in, you know, we see things through her eyes through it.
Yes, yes. And she gets a shit beat out of her from beginning to end and barely makes it out alive.
Yeah.
But I mean, the thing about it is, I personally like Predator. Can go the B movie route. It started out the B movie route, you know, like the high grade B movie route. But it's not with, but the when you do a movie with Alien in it, I expect you know to get like a good, you know, a good director, you know, some good ideas throwing around. And if it's a miss, at least it's an ambitious miss. So. But it, so then it was like, okay, I was watching and I'm like, okay, this is obviously going to be a low budget Alien movie. So that's a strike against it. But then I'm thinking, well, you know, if you'd make a, if this becomes what the title says, Alien versus Predator, and you have aliens fighting Predator from pretty much, you know, after about, I would give it 20 minutes to get there. But once you're about 20 minutes into the movie, it should be constant. If you're going low budget thriller, it should be constant blood and battle and
I don't give a shit about who built that thing in the ice. Show me the aliens and the predators.
It's way scarier if you don't know what the hell that is, and it's just there.
Exactly. I mean, we in Alien, do we know anything about the space jockey other than his ship is there? No.
Well, now we do, but
we can't tell
you about that. Yeah.
They're not in Alien. You know, watching Alien as its own entity, we don't know anything about that. And do we need to know any of it? No, because the story works with that mystery. Now, again, like you say, in Prometheus, that's filled in. That's fine. That's different. Okay, if we're doing an Alien versus Predator film, even with the setup from the first AVP, fine. It's a mysterious temple. Here's a hint. It's a mystery. Don't tell us what's going on. Give us what we asked for. One of the absolute...
It's, yeah, the movie isn't the mystery of the inverted pyramid under the ice. It's...
One of the most inane things that I've ever experienced, and I'm a horror movie fan, so inanity kind of comes with the territory, all right? When Freddy versus Jason was being released, I cannot tell you the number of people who would say, man, I'll just wait for Alien versus Predator. And I'd like to say, how are those two congruent? How does that make any sense? Because it's a crossover movie, they're all exactly the same? That doesn't make any sense. Now, if we had gotten an Alien versus Predator movie that was like Freddy versus Jason, I think we all would be singing a much different tune.
Yes, yes. I actually liked Freddy versus Jason because it was doofy.
It's a horror party movie, and that's what Alien vs. Predator needs to be. It's a movie that you get a bunch of gore hounds to your house, you get a case of your favorite beverage, and you sit down and you have a fucking ball watching aliens and predators kill each other for 90 minutes.
I'll tell you how they should have done that. They should have just adapted a side-scrolling arcade game of Alien vs. Predator.
Basically, yes.
Which was awesome, because there was a dude that was like Arnold Schwarzenegger with a robotic arm, and a tiny Asian ninja girl fighting alongside two Predator warriors against a shitload of aliens.
Yeah, and not only that, and then after the first four stages, you're fighting aliens, and you fight and kill a queen, and then you start fighting the Marines, because Weyland-Yutani has harvested all the eggs from the queen, and so now you're now fighting against the humans and more aliens that they have bred. And there's a bunch of scenes you fight through where it's clearly a lab where the aliens have hatched and killed all the technicians.
Awesome.
It's like this game. I will find a link to this game, either a playable one or a playthrough video, and put it on the forums, because this game, I mean, I've seen this game like once in an arcade. I've only ever played it on a...
I never knew it existed.
It's so much fun.
It's CPS2, which is Capcom Program System 2. It's kind of the same arcade board as a lot of Capcom's mid-90s games. And you can play it through a CPS2 or a KWAX-style emulator, and it is fantastic.
Yeah.
You're right, Hero. If they made that, we'd be like pigs in slop right now. So.
Yep.
But they didn't, so...
I heard
Alien versus Predator Requiem, which was slightly better.
I heard the problem with that is they like filmed it too dark. I heard it was literally like
it's too dark to see. It's filmed like a music video with the lights turned off. It's a lot of jump cuts. It's hard to tell what's going on. It's hard to follow. I mean, Hero, I think, hit the nail on the head. That should have been the tagline. Alien vs. Predator Requiem. It's better than the first one.
It's slightly better.
You know,
better than no praise.
Yeah. But you know what, though? To bring this full circle, that is the strength of the story from both Alien and Aliens, that that franchise can absorb, move below, lower rate movies like Alien versus Predator. It can absorb whatever you throw at it, and at the end of the day, it doesn't diminish Alien or Aliens. It doesn't diminish the cinematic power and the sheer frightening ability of the alien creature. And those films will be forever in the echelon of sci-fi and horror classics because of how well they are and the attention and care that was given to them. And the franchise that they spawned will be around forever.
Mm-hmm. And
agreed.
The Xenomorph is now in the same pantheon as the Universal monsters and stuff like that, you know. As just a monster, you know.
I mean, it's in a Disney theme park.
That's true.
The MGM, right?
Great movie ride, yeah.
Movie ride, yeah.
Oh yeah.
I love that bit too, because it's what's interesting is that in the Great Movie Ride, for those who are not familiar, and because this is the Two True Freaks podcast, we'll relate it back to Disney, you know. So
Scott
will be happy with us for another month. The Great Movie Ride was the showcase centerpiece ride at what was originally Disney MGM Studios, is now Disney Hollywood Studios. And it literally is riding through some classic movies where you're in a big car that's riding through recreations of scenes. There's, you know, that they're in Singing in the Rain at one point. We're in Mary Poppins. We go through Raiders of the Lost Ark. We go through some great gangster films like Public Enemy, and we go through Western area. And right after we go through the Old West, we pull through the doors, and suddenly we're on the Nostromo.
I remember that.
And I mean, you go from the brightly, you know, it's artificial sunlight, brightly lit Old West street that could have walked off of any Hollywood backlot of the 1950s. And then we're on the Nostromo, and it is cold. There is fog and mist everywhere. There are klaxons going off. And you are like, holy crap. And then we see Ripley hiding out. And then we see there's two different aliens, depending on whether you're in the front car or the back car, you will see a different animatronic of the alien. But it's like, that's how ubiquitous the alien is. It's in Walt Disney World, you know? So, and what other monster can make that claim, you know?
Yeah.
It's and I love it. And what's funny is in the narrative of the ride, depending, again, whether you're the front car or the back car, your car is stopped and hijacked by a character from one of the genre films. It's either a cowboy or a gangster who is driving your car at that point, and they are just freaked out beyond all belief. Okay, I don't know where I'm at right now, and I'm really kind of freaked out by this. You know?
God, I haven't been on that ride in 20 years.
I actually watched videos of that when I went to visit Scott last time and was going to Disney World and trying to decide what rides I wanted to go on. I was watching, you know, videos of people, and I was watching videos of that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of videos people have taken of that one that they've collected where the actors were sort of not having the best day. So those are pretty funny.
Well, what I know about you, Chris, that one seems right in your wheelhouse.
Right, exactly. That's what I would hope when I went on the ride, that you know, it would be like the day that one of the actors had a psychotic breakdown or something like that.
So, from psychotic breakdown, anyone have any other thoughts they want to talk about our retrospective on the Alien franchise?
Yeah, The first two movies are iconic. You can't imagine how much they've done for cinema, horror, action. They're great. The following two movies, while not as good, still fill in a lot of holes in the series, and it makes for just an enjoyable quadrilogy, you know. Something that, you know, I think will stand the test of time.
I agree. I think Sigourney Weaver holds the whole thing together. Basically, you know, she's the element. I get the feeling that if they did another Alien movie, you'd have a hard time keeping Sigourney Weaver away from the set. She seems to really enjoy. I would enjoy being Ripley if I was Sigourney Weaver. It's like the ultimate kick-ass role for a woman, you know. It's like being Uma Thurman in Kill Bill or something.
Yeah. I'll just reiterate what I said. It's like this is a franchise that has so much staying power and so much power to this day to scare. And that's impressive, because a lot of times when, especially even, you know, any horror franchise you want to talk about, eventually it gets to the point where the earlier ones are kind of tamed. And with Alien, you know, being so much of it suggested that it's never going to lose its power to scare.
Mm-hmm.
This movie was scary in 1979. It's scary in 2020. And then you look at Aliens, and you want to talk about the prototype for making a science fiction action movie. I mean, it's all right there on the screen. And once you get that kind of start, and really, it, you know, Alien was its own thing. Aliens comes along, spins it in a new direction, really launches the franchise. From there, it's the stuff of popular myth. And that's all I got to say. It's like, if you haven't seen Alien and Aliens or any of the others, you know, do yourself a favor and check them out, because if you're listening to this show, you will like it.
It's a franchise with legs and claws.
It's a horrible, clawed, sickening legs.
And two sets of jaws, yeah.
Yeah, extendable jaws, too. Yeah, that's
oh,
awesome.
Yeah.
Do you ever find yourself going to Amazon.com and buying some record or movie or some stupid thing that Two True Freaks have been talking about so that you can catch up on it, or you've been reminded of it or something? Well, now, how about this? Instead of going to Amazon.com, go to twotruefreaks.libsyn.com and follow our link to Amazon.com. When you do that, if you buy something over at Amazon, we get a little cut out of it, which is awesome, because we love money and it won't cost you a thing.
You can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy, and there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today. Visit our website at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Libsyn is spelled LIBSYN.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Join our forum at forumforgeeks.com, where you can discuss all of the shows on our feed with us and your fellow listeners.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
Dumbass.
And hey, you can friend me, Scott Gardner, on Facebook too. My name is spelled Scott Gardner.
You can friend me on Facebook too, if you can find me.
Now available, Two True Freaks t-shirts. See our website for details.
Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check that out at www.comicspodcast.com,
where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up.
We are also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks? Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
And this is your Uncle Don saying good night. Good night, little kids. Good night. We're off? Good. Well, that ought to hold the little bastards.